number one sports site in the world.
Live from the Quick and Loan studios of the Yahoo Sports Radio headquarters. Nighttime is the right time.
On the nighttime, the
it's Tony D on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining us here on Yahoo Sports Radio. Glad you could be with us as we continue to digest the fantastic performance by both teams in the national championship game on a Monday night in Houston. Villanova and North Carolina saw a lot of the reaction today and throughout the day of people saying, gee, this was as well played of a game as I've seen. This is one of those games where I wish there wasn't a loser. Both teams were exceptional. Both teams were entertaining. And of course, we are starting to process whether or not Chris Jenkins' three-point buzzer beater is the greatest of all time. And it's easy to do because it won a national championship. I mean, how great is that? You start to process some of the better three, buzzer beater performances in the NCAA tournament. Where does it rank? We'll get to that coming up throughout the show tonight. We'll also talk to Andrew Porter. That's coming up at the bottom of the hour. He's from CBSPhilly.com. And we'll get his thoughts on Villanova as a school and the fan base there. Is it a popular school in Philadelphia? It's a, Philly is a loaded sports town. Loaded. And here's this college with a lot of other colleges in the area. Don't forget, Drexel is there. Temple is there. Penn is there. And Villanova has got a lot of the, national prominence in basketball. John Chaney had a great team at Temple for years, but Villanova's now won two national titles in the span of, 31 years. And where does Villanova fit in the Philly landscape? Also, a lot of talk about Jay Wright and his reaction to the Jenkins shot, which is what we do now. This is really interesting. In a world where we can now break down film easier, where, stuff is on DVR and you can catch things and social media reacts to stuff. So because social media reacts to stuff, guys like me react to stuff, columnists react to stuff. All of a sudden, one of the other angles to the national championship game from Monday was, boy, Jay Wright seemed to be really calm and stoic and didn't really show a lot of emotion on this three-point shot that basically won him a national championship game. What does that mean? I don't know if it means anything, to be honest with you. I don't know if that's something we should be analyzing to death. But nevertheless, we'll talk to Andrew Porter about that coming up at the bottom of the hour from CBSPhilly.com. Boy, we got a lot to get to, Adam. I do this thing where I kind of come up with all these different kind of topics before the show. Just give you a little inside radio. I list a whole bunch of things, and I found myself going, oh my God, I think I've listed like five different sports on the outline tonight. Because we're all converging. We have the NFL. Vinny Iyer is going to join us from Sporting News at the bottom of the next hour. We're going to talk to him about this new Twitter deal that the NFL has got so you can stream games on your phone again. Slow down. I can't keep up with all this stuff. We're going to get to the college basketball. There's a little women's college basketball as UConn wins again. What else is new? Also, Major League Baseball, and how about the two controversies today? How long have we had opening day in Major League Baseball now? 3 days? Because of weather? We started on Sunday. We had opening day yesterday. I think the Tigers and the Marlins opened up today, if I'm not mistaken. Because we've had delays, so the Red Sox and the Yankees opened up today. So we've had like 3 days of opening day baseball. And there's already two controversies already. Baseball's been playing for like 10 minutes. We've got the slide in Tampa Bay that I'm still not sure of. And then we've got Carlos Correa running inside the base path against New York and Dylan Betances trying to throw it over his head like a lob shot that turned into a throwing error that allowed the Astros to score the go-ahead run in the eighth inning against the Yankees. Joe Girardi lost his mind. The rule is pretty much it's simple from the standpoint of the rule, but I guess it's not simple to get players to sort of get their minds around it. And the rule is Carlos Correa hit a shot and a little roller, and he's running down the baseline, and he's inside the baseline. Now, this is in the eighth inning at Yankee Stadium. The score is tied at 2. Correa is running inside the baseline. Now, because he's running inside the baseline, this could impede the throw of the pitcher to the first baseman. So Betances picks up the ball, and instead of throwing it at Correa, which he would be in his right to do, because Correa is inside the line and thus in the, you know, could interfere with the throw, Betances decides, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to lob it over his head to try to get it to the first baseman. So he shoots it like a basketball. He throws it up, but he throws it too hard. So it gets by the first baseman. The Astros score the go-ahead run, and they end up winning the game. Now, Girardi went through and protested this game, but the reality of it is, it seems like this was within the rule. If you want to enforce the running inside the baseline rule, you have to throw at the batter that's running to first base. You can't just go, he's running inside the line, he's out. He's only out if you throw the ball and hit him, because it shows that he's impeded the throw to first base. Girardi thinks this is dumb. I kind of think it's dumb, but I don't want rules to be changed because circumstances dictate that they could. So for the Yankees, for example, this might be a dumb rule, but you're not going to get the game back because the game is over and the rule was implemented correctly. Betances should have thrown at the back of Carlos Correa. If he couldn't throw the ball properly to first base, throw at his back. But Girardi makes this interesting point. Is that really what baseball wants to have happen? So Carlos Correa is a young star, and he's going to get pegged in the back by Dylan Betances because he ran inside the line? That's the rule? That's what we should be doing? So nevertheless, baseball starts off with a bang in New York on opening day. But the Astros end up winning that game. Didi Gregorius did have a home run, though. Probably one of five on the year, but nevertheless, he still had a home run. And then this play in Tampa Bay. It's even more interesting because this is sort of a new rule. This is called the Chase Utley rule. And basically, the Toronto Blue Jays had bases loaded in the ninth. And then there was a ground ball, and there was a runner at the plate, and Jose Bautista was sliding into second base and I guess tangled up with Logan Forsyth. And so this caused the Rays, Kevin Cash, to ask for a replay, and the replay ruled that Cash was correct, that Bautista's slide had violated this new double play slide rule. Because remember, Chase Utley got smacked around against the Mets. And now this game has been Tampa Bay's. They won 3-2 instead of Toronto, I think, tying the game at the time. So already two games on quote-unquote opening day, the third opening day that we've had on the season, Joe Girardi is upset, the Blue Jays are really upset, and we were only a couple of games into the season. Oh, I love it. I love it already. If there's one sport that new rules are hard to adjust to, it's baseball. Baseball is very set in its ways. When they implement new stuff, it does take a while. But according to what had happened, Bautista sliding into second, he grabs, I guess, Logan Forsyth and grabs his ankle as he's sliding into second base. As Forsyth is trying to turn the double play to end the game. I think it was one out at the time. And so the replay says, yes, as he was sliding in, Bautista did try to grab the ankle of Logan Forsyth, so he's out. And the run doesn't count, and the Blue Jays are very livid. This has been great. So we have that for you. Also, the Masters gets underway on Thursday. Jordan Spieth and the rest of the Masters champions had their dinner. And just for kicks, we'll tell you what Jordan Spieth, the Texan, served at the banquet. I'll give you a hint. It's Texan. Just in case you were wondering, what could a 22-year-old guy serve at the Masters? That gets underway. It's the par 3 contest that's coming up on Wednesday. And a little interesting tidbit on that. No one, and I mean no one, has won the par 3 and the Masters in the same year. Although Ray Floyd did come close in 1990, he won the par three and almost won a playoff over Nick Faldo of that year. So we'll get the Masters talk. And why Tiger Woods is still a story. He's not playing. I think he showed up for the dinner and everything, but he's not playing. And yet he has become a major story at the Masters. His absence, the second time in 3 years, is still becoming a major story. Why? With Jason Day and Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy and Ricky Fowler and Phil Mickelson, who plays that course pretty well, and a bevy of other international stars on the PGA Tour, why is Tiger still a story at Augusta? But coming up, as far as buzzer beaters go, where does Chris Jenkins rank? We'll debate that next. Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you
on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
Hey, thanks for joining us here on Yahoo Sports Radio. The Golden State Warriors are in a fight with the Minnesota Timberwolves. Can I just make an observation, Adam? And you can shoot me and tell me I'm an idiot. It feels like the last part of the season, we've got problems with the Warriors. They lost to the Celtics at home. They could lose this one. Is it over yet? I don't think it's still got about 2 minutes left to go in overtime.
Yes.
Okay. I feel like they did beat Portland and rather handedly, but I feel like we're watching a very tired basketball team. I mean, am I wrong?
No, not at all. They've had some really close games, some games they probably shouldn't have won that they've pulled out, and tonight's another example.
Yeah, this has really been wild. Minnesota, I mean, going to Oakland shouldn't be in an overtime game with a team that has been so focused on getting 73 wins. They want the shot. But look, if you're Golden State, listen, I get it. You get everybody's best game. Everybody wants the one shot. Golden State hadn't lost all year at home, and then Boston beat them, and now they trail by four with under a minute to go in this overtime. But look, 82 games is a long, long season, and it's a long season to be turning up your engine to 11 every single night, to use a Spinal Tap phrase. You can't do it. You have to have nights where, I'm sorry, you sleepwalk through a game. I've seen it way too often. I saw it a lot in Denver when the Nuggets were pretty decent. And teams would go on these road trips, and they'd start these West Coast road trips, and they would end up in Denver after four or five games. You know, they'd be wrapping up in Denver, and they'd be coming in, and there's altitude, and it's hard to breathe, and they're not adjusted, and their Nuggets would want to run a little bit. And you just go, whatever. Let's get the hell out of here. And that's the way these road trips are. And Golden State has been trying to win every single one of these games. Every single night they want. And I know, I get it. You want to give a show, you want to put your stamp on it. But don't go into the postseason beat up and tired and using up all your energy on this. If you don't get 73, you don't get 73. But if they don't win tonight, and it doesn't look like they will, they've got to win the last four games of the regular season to get it. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know if they can. San Antonio will give them nothing. I mean, San Antonio is already locked in the second seed. They're going to play nobody. They're going to rest everybody they possibly can. They can't possibly lose the number one seed in the West, unless they lose four in a row, I guess. But San Antonio is probably going to be very conservative in their lineup and the way they play. But I don't know. I just feel like I'm watching a very tired basketball team.
I don't think this is fact here, but do you see San Antonio carrying it all? Because their last home game, I'm pretty sure, is against the Warriors, and they could be going for 41-0 at home.
I think players would care about that. I think Popovich would be like, I don't even know.
Right.
I don't care.
I didn't even know.
Thanks for telling me. I wasn't even aware we were that. Yeah, we were that at home.
That's my thinking as
but
well.
I think if you're like Tony Parker, Tony Parker's probably like, yeah, that's probably cool. Like if you talk to Tim Duncan, he'd probably be like, nah, that'd be something. I mean, I've been here forever, and that's probably something I'd like to have as I close out my career. But, you know, Popovich will be like, no, you know what? We decided to have a contest, and we were going to suit up 12 fans for the game. Like, he just doesn't seem fazed by anything in the regular season. And to his credit, he gets total credit for that. Where people have problems with it is when you finally break the bank and buy that special ticket for your son to go to the one game you can afford, and you show up and Popovich is like, yeah, friends and family night, man. If you got a cousin that wants to suit up for the Spurs, we'll sign him to a 10-day contract because we ain't playing anybody. And I think against Golden State, he doesn't want to show them anything. So I don't think he wants to give them any sort of possible look on how this could go down. But we are in the last couple of seconds of this game, and I think Minnesota is going to pull this out. They're up 6 with the ball. All right, so I started to analyze the Chris Jenkins buzzer beater, because this is what I do. Because I end up in these Facebook fun conversations with people as to where this buzzer beater ranks in terms of the all-time greats. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the finals. And, you know, we were just having some fun tossing it back and forth. And I made the joke that this is the shot now that all of the promos for March Madness could start using in place of the Christian Laettner Kentucky shot. We've had that for about 20 years, a little over 20 years. Can we please move on to another game-winning shot that made us all go, whoa, and Chris Jenkins might actually have it? There have been a ton of buzzer beaters in the NCAA tournament, so it's very hard to sort of go through all of them to try to figure out where this ranks. And since most of them didn't happen in the championship game or in a Sweet 16 matchup or in an Elite Eight or a national semifinal, you can discount a lot of them. But a friend of mine pointed out something rather interesting in comparing this shot by Chris Jenkins to Laettner's shot or other big time buzzer beating moments, in that, and I don't know if this has a factor for you in terms of grading it, but his point I thought was pretty valid. He said, look, yes, it's a buzzer beater to win the national championship. Yes, it is a buzzer beater that ends a game and ends an entire season. The men's college basketball season ended on that play. And you can't ask for anything greater than that. But he said the reason that he thinks Laettner's shot is still the greatest shot in NCAA tournament history is that situation seemed impossible, and if Laettner missed it, Duke's season came to an end. Whereas Chris Jenkins was under no such pressure to hit that shot. If Chris Jenkins had missed that shot, we would have just had overtime. Now, you can say that North Carolina may have had momentum, or North Carolina was better suited in overtime. I don't want to hear it, because we'll never know. But that Jenkins had none of the season-ending, this-is-it, make-or-break pressure of his shot. Now, I did tell my friend, now, look, I think from a planning perspective, Laettner, I think from an X's and O's perspective, I think Villanova's shot last night was a little easier to diagram, given that A, it's a play Jay Wright has called a number of times, and it really didn't call for anything really magical given the lapsing defense of North Carolina, who just did not want to foul on that particular play. Hey, Bryce Johnson was nowhere near the play. Nobody was on Jenkins at all as he trailed it, as Archie Dinakino went to the top and kind of dribbled off the ball and gave him plenty of time and a really good look to knock it down. Whereas Laettner and Duke in 1992, if you remember the play correctly, they didn't know what Kentucky's defensive scheme was going to be coming out of the timeout. So Grant Hill was going to inbound the basketball. He could have had John Pelfrey in front of him. And instead, he had nobody in front of him. Kentucky also didn't put a body in front of Laettner on the play. So they didn't sandwich Laettner in to try to prevent him from catching the ball. They basically gave Laettner a chance to catch a pass. Duke did not know that that was going to be the defensive alignment coming out.
What's the common thing between both these plays? Terrible defense.
Terrible, terrible defense in which the other team was petrified to foul.
In both
watch
of them?
Watch the Duke turnaround. Watch Leitner's turnaround.
Yeah.
I don't know which Kentucky player is on the ball. I think it's John Pelfrey. He doesn't even really make a move.
No.
Because he's afraid to foul. Laettner was perfect at the line, so fouling, you're in trouble.
both of them were on the coaches because you need to be better at coaching for those.
Absolutely. So we'll dive into that a little bit more as to where that one ranks. We'll throw in Mario Chalmers as well. He had a three that was sent his game to overtime when Kansas played Memphis. Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you
on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
It's Tony D here on Yahoo Sports Radio as we continue to put a kind of a finishing bow on the NCAA tournament with Villanova, the national champs after beating North Carolina in that epic game on Monday. All right, what kind of team Villanova? How was it built? What is it like in Philadelphia? Andrew Porter joins us, sports editor at CBSPhilly.com, and he joins us here on Yahoo Sports Radio to talk about the Wildcats. How are you, Andrew?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Andrew, let's say I moved to Philadelphia and I'm getting assimilated with all the sports teams in that area. How prominent is Villanova?
Well, Philly's predominantly a pro sports town, as you probably know. It's a 4-for-4 town, 4 pro sports teams. But college basketball is pretty. It's big here. There's a large tradition. Telestra. We like to think of it as the Big Five is very popular here. And that is St. Joe's LaSalle, Nova, Temple, and one more I'm forgetting, Drexel, and Penn. That's a City Six. So yeah, but Nova's the best. Nova's the biggest. Nova's the biggest of the bunch, and they've been the most successful, definitely over the last decade. They are the only one with a national championship, and I mean, it's a big deal.
I moved to Nashville a couple of years ago, and Vanderbilt is the prominent school in that city, but it's also, it's a private school. It's kind of an elite institution, and most of the people that I live near and around are mostly University of Tennessee fans. Is Villanova like that? Is it more on the periphery of fandom, or do average Philly fans tend to gravitate towards Villanova?
No, average fans gravitate towards Villanova. We all root for Philadelphia sports fans root for all the college teams in the area, for the most part. I think it's been a largely drummed up a narrative that's been built up these past few weeks that people aren't backing Nova in Philadelphia because they either went to Temple or Nova has an elitist attitude. I just think it's all BS. I think 95% of the city was rooting for Villanova. I think if when the Eagles are in the playoffs, if you do polls, who are you rooting for? You'll get 5%. Just idiots rooting against them, just because that's just the way sports is. I think the vast majority of the city was behind Villanova, and we'll see that. There's going to be a parade on Friday.
I've never met him, but I really like Jay Wright, and I kind of root for him when I have no other rooting interest in the tournament. What is he like to cover? What is he like to deal with when it's not the hoopla of the tournament, but just an average basketball game in January?
I've been in Philadelphia my whole life. I went to Penn State for 4 years, but other than that, I've been in Philadelphia. I've been working in the media for 4 years now, and I've never heard a bad word about the guy. Downright from, like, you know, at days at UNLV, from his days as an assistant, on and on. I haven't found like someone who doesn't like the guy. He's just genuine. He really is genuine. And the thing that gets me, he's so humble and his sportsmanship is great. Like every time he loses a game, or wins a game, he can't wait to console the defeatist opponent or to help the defeatist opponent or, you know, to offer a lending hand, words of wisdom. Very respected around here.
It's amazing because at the end of the game, it's almost like now becoming like, all right, let's try to find different angles and things we can kind of talk about. And one of the conversations today was, hey, look at Jay Wright. After Jenkins hits the shot, he's kind of stoic. He's not leaping and jumping up and down. Like, are you surprised by that? Or are you like, oh, no, that's Jay Wright. That's kind of what you expect for even in a moment like that. That's kind of the way he is.
I was surprised. I was disappointed just because that's such a ridiculous moment. Like, I was ready for him to be sprawled out on the floor. Like, that's how we all were watching the game. But, no, I mean, he talked about it, and he said he thought that there still might be time left. And his mind is cranking onto the next play, because he's thinking there might be 0.3, 0.4 seconds left. He asked the ref. The ref said, we're going to look at it, and ended up being good at the buzzer. So he didn't really have a time to react. That was his interpretation of it. And if you read his lips, there's vines going around. You can read his lips. He said he always says bang when one of his players takes a last-second shot. So that was kind of his thought process behind the whole thing.
Andrew Porter joins us, sports editor, CBSPhilly.com on Villanova as we wrap up the NCAA tournament. I was blown away by their shooting percentage, not only in these two games, but in the whole tournament as well. The numbers really are just staggering. From a perspective of seeing this team, is there something to this, or is it just, you know, some teams just catch a right fire? Do you see something in the Villanova practices or the way they are geared that say, yeah, these are the kind of shooting percentage, maybe not that high, but these are the kind of shooting percentages that Villanova does do?
No, that's what this team is. That's how they're built. That's how they've been constructed for a while under Jay Wright. A lot of guards, a lot of guys who can shoot. And they all can. A lot of them, I mean, they play eight. They're pretty much eight deep, and they really all can shoot. Chris Jenkins is their best shooter, but Archie Diakono can shoot. Josh Hart can step out and shoot. Jalen Brunson can knock down a shot. They have guys that can shoot, and they've been a good shooting team all season long. They just got hot at the right time, and it's the perfect mix. I mean, you see it in sports all the time. It's not how you start, it's how you finish.
Give us an idea of Archie Diakono, because I think now with the MVP award, he's really jumped on the national scene. What has his 4 years been like at Villanova, the progression from teams that couldn't get out of the first two weekends, you know, first weekend to now national champs?
Yeah, only player in Nova history, 1,500 points, 500 assists. Every time I watch him play, and I played in high school myself, I think of myself, because he's just like an everyman's man. You know, a little 6'3" white kid that's running around there. And he's just, I'm kind of in awe of him every time. It's like, how is he doing this? What makes him so good? Jay Wright talks about how he doesn't even have to talk to him before the games anymore, because he says, and basically I'm quoting him, Jay Wright says they think the same. They're like the same person. So he doesn't even have to. He says it makes his job so much easier, because when you have a leader and a point guard like that on the floor, he's really became such a leader, and that's the best part about his game. It's so savvy. It's so smart. You see, I mean, the uncanny turnover late in that game last night, and then he follows it with that great assist to end the game. So that's kind of the dichotomy of Archie Diakono. He's just a really smart guy, and Jay Wright just fully trusts him. They developed a great relationship, and Arch and Daniel Ochefu together, they've really, you know, bookend this thing for 4 years, getting to, you know, be seniors and do this thing together as seniors. And that's kind of the guys Jay Wright looks for when he recruits. That's no mistake. You know, he finds those guys. They seek those kind of players, maybe not the best athletes, the five-star athletes, the dominant kind of high school talent, but guys that will be there for 3-4 years, and he's building a program, and that's really what he tries to do, and it's worked beautifully this year.
I might be showing my age a bit, but he kind of reminds me in terms of leadership, like Bobby Hurley at Duke, because when Hurley arrived there, Coach Krzyzewski said, you're the guy, you're going to run this team, even as a freshman, I need you to display a leadership role. I know his dad went to school there, and I know he's got that Villanova tie, but how quick did Jay Wright go, Ryan, this is your team, you got to take it?
Not right away, and that's maybe the fun storyline, but he did trust him right away. It was a gradual trust, and Arch earned it quickly, but as the years went on, last year it was basically his team, but as a sophomore, you can see it coming. You know, it was developing, and he was playing a lot of minutes, and he was controlling the game flow, and by junior year, it was pretty much his team.
What was the surprising thing for you, knowing this team and the way they play? They were coming in. A lot of people said, look, North Carolina's got depth. They've got the bigs. This is going to be a tough opponent for Villanova. Was there anything surprising the way Villanova played last night?
Not really. That's been their MO all season long. Scrappy, play really good defense, and shoot the lights out. They're really good. Surprisingly, they only shot 77% from the line. That's been bad for them. They missed a couple late foul shots last night. I did think that UNC's length and athleticism would get to them. And I was, you know, it was weird how Nova was handling their bigs down low. They had a lot of times they had smaller guards on Bryce Johnson or Meeks once in a while. And it looked like a mismatch, but UNC just never found a way to get Bryce Johnson going. And it really worked. But no, that's been Nova's MO really from the get-go. That's their formula. They stuck with it from day one, the last six games. I mean, that's just how they play.
Again, Andrew Porter, sports editor, CBSPhilly.com on Villanova and their national championship. Andrew, great talking to you. Great insight, not only in the city, but the school. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for that.
All right, coming up next, is Jay Wright's stoic nature good? We'll talk about that next. Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
All right, thanks for joining us here on Yahoo Sports Radio. As we continue through the night tonight, again, putting the finishing touches on Villanova's win over North Carolina. Like I said, listen, it was such a good game, and it was such a good finish that I think naturally people are going to gravitate towards the where does this rank all time? It was that kind of game. We don't do this with every single sporting event. There are some times we see a Super Bowl that doesn't live up to its hype. We get a World Series matchup that doesn't live up to its hype. This one was as entertaining of a basketball game as I can remember. Doesn't mean it's the best. I'm sure if I put my mind to it, I may find another one. But I thought that it's going to be hard for me to find one because I thought both teams played well and then both teams struggled, but then both teams overcame those struggles. And in the end, we got a really, really, really entertaining game. And it's not because it ended well. It's not because Marcus Page hit a three-pointer the way he did, and then Chris Jenkins hit a three-pointer the way he did. It's not because that didn't make the whole game entertaining. The whole game was entertaining because both teams played really well, and then both teams didn't play really well, and then they both overcame it. And I agree with a lot of the conversation of I wish there was co-champs, I wish there wasn't a loser. It's too bad one team had to lose. That's a sign of a good game. That's a sign of a Hallmark game when you feel enough empathy for the losing team, like people did with North Carolina. To lose the way they did. They hit this miraculous shot. I mean, Marcus Page, if you remember it, he goes up. He has to readjust. He's readjusting in midair. He basically throws it up. It lands in. It's a tie game. Looks like we're heading into overtime. And then Chris Jenkins trailing a play from Archie Diacono just gets the feed on a play that they practice all the time. And he knocks it down. By the way, thanks to Andrew Porter and CBS Philly to help us break down Nova. And not only that, but the city's reaction to the national championship. Look, Villanova is a school that's in a really interesting hotbed of sports. I mean, with Eagles and Flyers and terrible Sixers basketball and, of course, Philadelphia, the Phillies. But it's also got Drexel, Temple, Penn, Villanova. The Palestra is a college basketball iconic venue. It is St. Joe's. I mean, there's a lot of good college basketball there. There's even good Division II basketball. I remember Philly Textile was a really good Division II basketball team back in the day. So it's a hotbed of competition, right? For fans and for fandom. And Villanova's certainly got its share because they've been on the national scene for so many years, not only just in 85, but what Jay Wright has done there. And I want to get to Jay Wright for a second because in talking to Andrew Porter about this, there was a natural sort of dissecting of what we saw on Monday night, and it led to people looking at the sort of stoic nature of Jay Wright. Chris Jenkins hits the shot. Everybody's celebrating. Wright is very calm, and he doesn't show emotion. He said afterwards he was thinking about whether or not there was going to be time left, and then how do you coach that? And so his mind was always thinking, next play, next play. Is there going to be a next play? Remember, they did have to review the shot. And so he's not going to celebrate yet. He's got a mind frame of a coach, which is we're always coaching, always coaching, always coaching until the game is absolutely in the books. Now, that's being sort of heralded as the mark of genius. Good coaches, why they don't overreact. Good coaches are stoic in nature. Whether it's a Nick Saban in Alabama or Bill Belichick, or you know, the good coaches are ones that are very calm and they stay that way through and their brains are always thinking. And I think that's very, very simplistic, but it's not actually accurate. Because we do have a lot of good coaches out there that are not stoic and have been demonstrative. And are very good. For example, the late Jim Valvano was very demonstrative, and he was a very good coach. Jim Harbaugh is a very demonstrative guy, and he is a very good coach. Now, whether you agree with the overreaction, Bob Knight was very demonstrative, and he was a very good coach. And John Calipari is doing the exact same thing at Kentucky. This idea that because Bill Belichick and Nick Saban don't show motion when they're winning all of these titles, that that's the hallmark, or that characteristic means that that's the way you should be if you want to be considered a coaching genius, that is too simplistic and, to be honest with you, downright incorrect. The stoic nature of Bill Belichick and Nick Saban is not in reference to them being genius. It's just the way they are. It doesn't correlate into being a genius. There are plenty of college coaches and pro coaches that are not out, do not wear their emotions on their sleeve, and yet do not get jobs and have not gotten jobs and do not get hired because they're lousy coaches. This is not a characteristic only the great ones have. If you're a great coach, you don't show emotion. Baloney. That is just trying to simplify this. That is just trying to take this and taking it to another level it doesn't need to go. Jay Wright always coaching, fine, great, that's a good moment. He was right. That shot went down, but he didn't know if there was time on the clock. So he's not going to lose his mind yet because he doesn't know if the game is over. I think a lot of good coaches would be in that similar situation. But to say that Jay Wright is like Bill Belichick and is like Nick Saban, truly the greats of the game, the geniuses of college basketball. Well, this genius couldn't get out of the first round of the last couple of years after having a team that was seeded 1 and 2. I like Jay Wright. But this isn't a characteristic that only geniuses have, because I like the way Jim Harbaugh coaches, and he wears his heart out on his sleeve, and so does Pete Carroll. He does the exact same thing, and so did Bob Knight, so does John Calipari. This is not something that needs to be sort of put in sort of, if you're great, you do this. No, if you're great, you win. If you're great, you turn around programs. It doesn't matter what your attitude is on the sidelines. If you accomplish those things, then you're great. Yahoo Sports Radio.